Shine up your apples, sharpen your pencils. It's back to school time. Around the country, schools have opened their doors or are just about to. I'm Adrienne Hill in for Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. This week, we're talking about education. We start our show today with literacy, the ability to read and write, which is a skill most everybody needs to take part in our economy. In Michigan, there's a lawsuit that claims literacy as a constitutional right under the 14th Amendment, a right that students and families in Detroit say the state-run schools failed to meet. They're suing with the help of the pro bono law firm Public Counsel. On Thursday, the state argued a motion to dismiss the case, claiming there is no fundamental right to literacy and saying the schools aren't the only ones to blame. Lizzie visited Detroit and brings us this story.
It's hot and sticky in Detroit, and Jamarie Hall is hungry. He's 17, tall, absolute megawatt smile, and we're heading out for a bite to eat after his summer job at Wayne State University, boarding up abandoned houses.
It makes you feel like you're making a difference in people's everyday lives. It makes people feel safer walking to school or walking to work or something like that.
At Grandy's Coney Island, a local fast food joint, he goes for the total teenage boy order.
Yeah, so I'll probably just get the bacon cheeseburger with the fries and pop.
The food gets packed up, and we find a mostly intact picnic table to sit at. It's in a little park across the street from Hall's house in a neighborhood between 7 and 8 mile roads. He just graduated from Osborne Evergreen Academy of Design and Alternative Energy. It's one of the schools accused of failing to provide students with access to literacy.
There's been teachers that walked out of the classes saying they can't deal with it because it's hot in the classes. Boiler pipes are broken, so there might be steam coming out the heat or something like that. And then when it's cold outside, it's super cold in the building, so people might have on coats and things like that. Then there's might be rodents or anything in the class.
Plus endless substitute teachers and textbooks older than he is that he wasn't allowed to take home.
I just feel like I've been cheated. Like out of my last 4 years of high school, I feel like I've been cheated. Like why shouldn't I be able to when there's other students out here that can? Like it shouldn't be like that.
Why do you think it is?
Because of the community that we live in, where we were born, where we happen to live. Maybe because of our skin color.
Detroit's school system is complicated. Since 1999, the city's schools have been in and out of some form of state control. This fall, Detroit's new school board takes over. Detroit's test scores are consistently some of the lowest in the country. On average, 7% of eighth graders are proficient in reading. Part of what makes this case so important is the state of Michigan's argument. In the motion to dismiss the case, state lawyers argue that the obstacles kids in Detroit face, poverty, lack of parental involvement, domestic violence, and trauma, make it too hard to trace illiteracy to failing public schools. We reached out to the state attorney general's office, and they declined to comment because the litigation is ongoing.
They're saying they can't educate people because there's a poverty issue. But for me, they're saying you must negate poverty and educate anyway.
That's Shallon Miller. She teaches at Cody Medicine and Community Health Academy, one of the plaintiff schools. We dropped by Miller's house on the west side of Detroit. She was grilling jerk chicken in the backyard for a late lunch. And at Cody, Miller wears a lot of hats.
Not only am I a resource teacher at my high school, I'm the testing coordinator, I'm the union rep, I'm the senior prom advisor. So I have a home.
These aren't just issues at Cody. As of this spring, there were 263 teacher vacancies at Detroit Public Schools.
When you say uncertified teachers can teach in the city but nowhere else, what kind of policy is that? So for your children, certified teachers. For city children, black and brown children, placeholders.
All of this has largely been in the state's hands for more than 15 years. I mentioned earlier, that's changing. A city school board regains control of the public schools starting this fall.
We're doing everything that we can to remediate some of the adverse effects of decades of educational inequity.
That's Ellie Savitt, a senior advisor to Detroit's mayor, Mike Duggan.
We need to have a school system that's training Detroiters to get those jobs without the bridge programs that we're providing, to be college ready.
He wrote a brief in support of the plaintiff's case.
Full economic revitalization is not going to be achieved when the illiteracy rates are so high. you know, literacy is foundational.
Right now, the city, nonprofit groups, and private companies often have to run classes and programs to close the education gap. One of those companies is DTE Energy, the big local utility. We took the elevator to the 23rd floor to meet with Diane Antishin, Vice President of Human Resources Operations at DTE. A big part of her job is creating programs that help DTE build a workforce. That means internships for high school kids, including from some of the plaintiff schools, and sometimes extra training.
We're assessing the young people while they're here. We actually put them through a diagnostic assessment yesterday to understand their literacy and numeracy skills, because we want them to be able to continue on to the program that we've developed in partnership with a local college, and we want them to be ready for success when they land there.
Antishin says three big reasons that Detroiters don't get jobs at DTE are lack of basic literacy or ninth grade math skills, failed drug tests, and lack of transportation. For kids coming out of Detroit public schools, a little extra help from private industry can make a big difference. When we sat in the park with Jamarier Hall, I asked him about that skills gap and whether the kids in his class had trouble reading.
Probably most of them, to be honest, like probably can't sit there and read a real 12th grade novel or something like that. I probably can't even because my last couple of years, I don't think that my reading skills have advanced that much. It's not that they're dumb. It's just they haven't been taught the 9th through 12th grade necessities, and it probably goes back before that, too.
Hall is headed to community college in Florida this fall. He wants to be an accountant. I asked him if he was scared about the future, maybe going to college and not feeling prepared. He thought for a second and then said that after getting through Osborne, well,
I'm ready for anything. I'm not going to let anything stop me, basically. I know I'm not going to go there and be the smartest in the class or know everything that the professor is talking about, but I know I'm smart enough to ask for help. I know I'm smart enough to use my resources.
For now, he's watching this lawsuit. And if plaintiffs win this case, it could change the way public schools all across the country look at literacy. I'm Lizzie O'Leary for Marketplace.
For more on the lawsuit and its implications, we've got Mike Griffith. He's school finance strategist at the Nonpartisan Education Commission of the States. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
The plaintiffs here are arguing that illiteracy is traceable to these schools, this school system. In response, the state points to other factors that contribute to illiteracy, including poverty, lack of parental involvement, medical problems, intellectual limitations. Does the state have a point here?
There is research that shows that it's more difficult to educate students who experience these sort of high poverty issues, including lack of regular food, lack of parental support. But just because it's harder doesn't mean that it's not achievable. There are districts around the country that have high poverty rates, that have low education achievement rates in their area, yet still are able to graduate their students, to get them up to state standards, and to definitely meet that lower benchmark of illiteracy. There is an argument out there that schools alone can't do this, that they need other supports, that a lot of the things that we hear from high-poverty school districts is that we spend so much time supplying basic needs for these kids, so providing them with a safe environment, providing them with food, that they don't have enough resources to put into basic education. Usually when they're making this argument, it's to get kids up to state standards, which is a much higher level. Parents' involvement in education is extremely important. There's just no way that the school district can kind of influence that. They can help parents who want to try, but if a parent doesn't want to help their kids or is unable to help their kids, then there's nothing much the school district can do.
That brings me to my next question, which is how does Detroit compare to other cities, other states with sort of a similar demographic?
In all honesty, a lot of the larger urban districts are struggling. We would tend to think of comparing Detroit to Philadelphia, Chicago, Cleveland. Some, like Chicago, had some successes for years, but seem to, you know, be struggling a bit more now. They need all the educational resources that kids in suburban and rural districts get. But they also need what we tend to call wraparound services, which are all the other services that exist in schools. And they need additional funds for those. There's a lot of good research out there that shows once you get to more than half of your kids being low-income or at-risk kids, you need additional resources for those kids. Hmm. So what we would say is each individual at-risk kid needs additional resources to begin with. Then as you move beyond 50%, the cost per kid then goes up even higher. So Detroit struggles getting their kids to graduate and getting their kids up to state standards and then moving those kids on to either work or some sort of post-secondary education. It's been struggling with its finances. It's been struggling with how it educates its kids. The hope now is they've hit kind of a stable point or a little more stable than they've been in a while. Their hope is that they can use this stability to move forward. But what this lawsuit brings forth is this idea that all of these struggles have shown that they're having a difficulty getting their kids even at the lowest bar, which is simple literacy.
If the plaintiffs, as this case winds through the courts, and it sounds like there's a long and windy path in front of it, if the plaintiffs are successful at the end and they establish there is a constitutional right to literacy, what would the implications of that be?
So this ruling actually could impact schools around the country because this is being tried not in state court but in federal court. That would mean that it's not just Detroit school kids, but all kids around the country, theoretically, if this went all the way to the Supreme Court, that would have the right to literacy within their schools. Now, granted, that's a pretty low bar. The goal in most states isn't literacy. The goal is to get them up to state standards, which is significantly higher. But what it could mean is it could force states around the country to start putting more resources into high poverty areas that have a disproportionately high percentage of their kids that are not at full literacy. The courts have said in the past, education is not a federal right. It's not within the U.S. Constitution. That means that it devolves down to the states. So if you end up having this kind of move on to the courts, you have to ask yourself, what are the federal courts going to decide that's going to be different this time? Are they going to say that, well, maybe different parts of education aren't protected, but the basic right to literacy is? And that's something that's going to be up to the courts to decide.
Mike Griffith is school finance strategist at Education Commission of the States. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can read more about this case on our website. We're at marketplace.org. It's August, we're almost 2 weeks in, and for a lot of kids, it's back to school time. Parents, on average, spend about $500 per kid this time of year, according to a study from Deloitte. The back-to-school shopping season pulls in $27 billion with a B dollars in sales, which is a whole lot of backpacks and computers and emoji t-shirts. I've got a son headed to school for the first time this year. So far, I've spent about $50 on school supplies, pencils, paper, markers, Kleenex, a new lunchbox, and another $50 or so on new t-shirts and shorts, because five-year-old boys, you probably know, if you've got one, are not kind to their clothes. We asked you what you're planning to spend.
Hi, my name is Laura Strait. I'm from Indianapolis, Indiana. I have two kids. New school supplies cost me $150, and that doesn't include any backpacks because they're using their last year's backpacks. I don't know why a first grader needs 12 jumbo glue sticks plus four more for Spanish and art class. I bought six boxes of 24 crayons for one kid, and this is public school. It's amazing.
And as kids get older, what they need changes.
My name is Meg Duskamp. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I have two college-age daughters. So that means that my back-to-school shopping has changed a lot over the years. On the positive side, I no longer have to buy hand sanitizer, reams of copier paper, cartons of facial tissue. On the slightly less positive side, I'm currently outfitting daughter number two to head across the country and start college in Virginia. I'm going to miss her like crazy. I'll spend less than $1,000 getting her set up, but I'm not yet sure of the total cost. Obviously, that cost doesn't include plane tickets, even though that's part of back-to-school costs.
Some parents are choosing to spend a little extra money to keep things easy.
Hi, I'm Brandon Smith from Cleveland, Ohio. I'm the proud dad of an 8-year-old son and a 6-year-old daughter. When it comes to back-to-school shopping for clothes, my wife and I are really lucky to have supportive parents and grandparents that'll do a lot of the shopping. When it comes to their actual school supplies, the last couple of years we've used a website in which you can order all of the school supplies specific to your child for their grade, and all that stuff is shipped right to the school. I ordered all of my kids' school supplies back in early April. It cost about $96, which I know can be a little bit expensive, but they have very specific items that they need, be it 48 sharpened pencils for my daughter or 7 or 8 folders for my son. And it was just more convenient for me than to be in a big box store fighting for folders and glue sticks.
Let's stay with that school supply service Brandon Smith mentioned. It's a family-owned business called First Day School Supplies, based in Medina, Ohio. Co-founder Mike Meadows is trying to carve out his own little part of the back-to-school market.
So what we do is we take the teacher's list, the exact supplies that a teacher's requested, and we custom kit them, and we put them in a beautiful box, almost gift-wrapped, if you will, and we deliver it to the school so that on the first day of school, the child will have their own box of school supplies sitting on their desk, ready to go.
Ring, ring goes the bell. The cook in the lunchroom ready to sell.
So we service schools all over the country. We go as far west as Orange County, California, and as far east as New York City. So it's a very complex process. There's a lot of moving parts and pieces. To give you perspective, next year we'll kit about 6 million items. We have some schools that require 75 items, and the kits range in $110 a kit. And then we have other schools that have 35 items, and it might be closer to $40 a kit. So the list through the years have gotten more complicated. They've pushed more supplies on parents, such as towels and tissues and hand sanitizers, and ancillary items like calculators and earbuds and flash drives, and especially art projects, right? So now a parent can't just go to Walmart and get the products they want. They have to visit multiple stores, or they have to go online and try to cobble together this. We take teachers' lists, and then we've automated the process for purchase, so parents, all they have to do is log on to our website, select their school and grade, and push a button. And they don't have to fight those lines and all the chaos that comes with back-to-school shopping at Walmart or Target. They go right to our site, the convenience of their home, and push a button, they're done. We satisfy all three parties, parents, teachers, and students, but teachers are probably our biggest fan. You're oftentimes left with buying these budget-branded, underperforming products that just don't work. And if you asked any teacher, they'd want you to come in with Ticonderoga pencils. We've affordably priced our kits to schools so that we give them the option, if they so choose, to add whatever dollar amount they want to make it a fundraiser. Many of our schools also designate a donate a kit to a child in need button. And so what that is you can buy a kit and then you can donate a kit to a child in need. And that's just a really nice service for our clients to give back to those who are needy.
You can share your back-to-school stories on our website. We're at marketplace.org. Parents aren't the only ones who spend big getting ready for the school year. Teachers, turns out, also hand over about $500 of their own money each year on school supplies. That's according to a Scholastic survey. Some teachers, especially those in high-poverty schools, will spend more than $1,000 out of pocket. Los Angeles math teacher Carrie Barrett says she doesn't need that much, but she will spend a couple $100 readying her classroom for the high schoolers who'll pour in next week. I stopped by her home as she was gathering supplies to see what was on her back-to-school shopping list.
Yeah. Good morning. Hi, Carrie. I'm Adrian.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
You too.
How long have you been a teacher?
This will be my third year, my second year teaching high school. I love math. I love talking about math. I wanted to talk about math every day. So this is one of very few jobs where you get to do that.
What? So I want to ask, we're talking about sort of getting ready for the school year. What have you been, you're going back this week. What have you been getting ready for?
Well, I had a week-long professional development. I spent a few days mapping out exactly when I'm going to teach what. And, of course, you know, buying some stuff.
So, yeah, how much do you spend every year buying stuff for your classroom?
My first year, I probably spent, like, maybe $300.
Okay.
Last year, maybe a little bit less, a couple hundred dollars, a little less than that. We'll see what happens this coming year.
Can we go see what you've purchased so far?
Sure. We can talk about the stuff that's in here first if you want. Oh, yeah. Like little treats and stuff for the kids. The school's not going to buy those for me. So I bought these erasers as birthday gifts.
And they're little emoji erasers.
Yeah, little emoji erasers that I thought were cute, just, you know, off of Amazon. Little stuff like this, the kids really appreciate you, like, acknowledging their birthday and, like, it's, you know, a day for them. So it's definitely worth it. They're, like, I don't know, less than 20 cents a piece. It's worth 20 cents to me to see a smile on a kid's birthday. Right before school starts is definitely the best time to get a lot of this stuff. Like, a composition book is normally, like, $2 or $3, but if you go the week before school starts, they're, like, 50 cents. So I like to get, you know, a few dozen, especially for kids who, like, aren't going to get a chance to go to the store. Like, I'll buy it for 50 cents plus tax and then have the kids give me 50 cents for it, just so that I don't have to be nagging them all the time to get their composition book.
Oh, that's interesting. So you'll buy supplies and sort of know that you'll just hand them out to kids in the classroom for what you paid for them.
Exactly.
Yeah, let's see what you have in your car now. All right, tell us what we have in here.
I bought the bulletin board paper. They have, like, the colored butcher paper at school that they provide for free, but it doesn't have very much width, so you either have to make a really skinny bulletin board or, like, layer it over itself, and it's not very cute. Board decorations, more emojis.
Yes.
Popsicle sticks, classic teacher stuff. For writing names on so that you can call on kids randomly and it's not like you're always calling on the same person. And
I guess as a math teacher, you have to care about randomness. It's a better way then.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah, so what is if you buy something that you think the school will reimburse you, how does that process go?
At our school, I would ask either the vice principal or the principal about it. Get it approved. Then there's some paperwork I have to fill out. It's not like a ton, but I have to go to the office manager and let her know that I'm doing it. Go buy it. Bring back a receipt to the office manager with the paperwork. And then it takes, I don't know, a few weeks at least to get the money back. So the last time I did that, it was for spiral notebooks, because I'm kind of particular about which ones I want the students to use. And, you know, in order to get $22 from the school, I had to do all of that.
Wow.
Yeah. There are a lot of school districts across the country that get a lot less money than we do. There's a lot of teachers that have to buy their own paper all year because they only get a few reams. I end up buying a couple of reams of my own paper every year, too.
If your school got sort of an influx of cash, would you want it to go to supplies or would you put it towards something else?
I think the number one request that our teachers had in budget development last year was an extra box of paper.
That's remarkable.
Yeah.
What do you wish that parents, even kids, understood about, like, school budgets and what teachers do for their classroom?
A teacher will be super grateful forever if you buy them the nice whiteboard markers. And make sure that your students know that just the little things that are around all the time are the things that it's most likely that your teacher spent their own money on. So if you could be nice to those, it would be great.
And let me just ask one more thing. Do you think teachers should have to spend that money?
No. We don't make that much money. We make, you know, enough. And classroom environment is a really important thing to have.
Carrie, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You can read more about what Carrie Barrett purchased at marketplace.org. And if you're a teacher, share how you balance your budget, what you bought for the school year. Our email is weekend@marketplace.org. Find us on Facebook, look for Marketplace Business News, and on Twitter, we're Marketplace WKND. Lunch shaming. Maybe you've heard about it. It happens when a kid can't pay for their school lunch. There have reportedly been instances where a kid had to help clean up the lunchroom to pay off their debt, where the school stamped the words, "I need lunch money," on a child's arm, or cafeteria staff threw away the hot lunch of kids who couldn't pay. Earlier this year, New Mexico made news when it banned lunch shaming in schools. And this summer, the U.S. Department of Agriculture asked every school district in the country to write down their plans for how they deal with those unpaid lunch debts. That way, everyone could be on the same page. Brandon Lips is the newly appointed administrator of the Food and Nutrition Service at the USDA.
I think the guidance makes a lot of sense. You know, I grew up in a very small town in Texas, and the folks in my school cafeteria were important to me. School food professionals are looking these young children in the eye every day. You know, I think we need to remember that there's a lot of good going on in this situation, and to allow those people who are with those kids every day to make these decisions is certainly the best policy.
Lip says sometimes school food staff gets a bad rap.
I don't know that anyone intentionally sets out to harm a child in these situations. I think our schools as a whole, the administration, the school food professionals, they're all there to serve those children to make sure that they have the nutrition that they need to learn. And they're all doing the best that they can to deal with the financial realities that they've been given.
Palm Springs Unified School District here in California is one of the schools rethinking how it feeds kids who can't pay and how it tries to collect that money. Stephanie Bruce is the director of nutrition services there. She says their policy has evolved over time. We reached her on the first day of the new school year.
We used to allow charging for students who didn't have money to pay for meals. There really was no cutoff, so the charges got a little out of control. So we did institute a no charging policy about 3 years ago. And what we did in that case, if the students didn't have money, they could get what we called a courtesy meal, which was a milk, and then they could go have anything they wanted off the salad bar. But that also pulled on the heartstrings of our employees.
Right.
So we have now developed a new policy.
You said charging was out of control. What did it look like?
Well, when I first started here about 4 years ago, the debt at the time was $35,000.
Wow, in unpaid school lunch bills.
Unpaid school lunch bills in 1 year.
Huh. So what is the policy now? What did you guys switch it to?
We actually have what we call, it's like a deferred payment policy. And if students come through the line and they don't have any money, our operators send them through the line, let them get a lunch just like anybody else would. And then we print up a negative balance report. We provide it to the principal, who then contacts the parents to let them know that their student didn't have money today, and if they could please send money tomorrow or go online and create a online pay account.
And everybody's going to eat.
And honestly, everybody should eat. I mean, a hungry child can't learn. And, you know, many of our students, it's the, you know, most nutritious meal they get in a day. I'll tell you, our breakfast on Mondays is our most participated meal, and it's because a lot of students don't eat very much over the weekend.
Is it working? Is it better for you guys?
Well, we'll let you know. This is our first day.
This is the very first day of the new policy, huh?
It's the first day of the new policy. You know, with our no charging policy that we did the last couple of years, it worked pretty well, but it was still, you know, embarrassing to the students to bypass the main line and go over to the salad bar,
right,
for lunch. So this, you know, all the staff was all trained last week on the new policy, and the sense of relief from them was so amazing that I think this is going to be a much better option, not just for the students, but for our staff involved.
The staff all was relieved with the new policy.
Yes.
What'd that look like? What'd they say?
You know, it was kind of like they just had been holding their breath all year and they exhaled in training.
Huh.
You know, because typically what happens, you know, students come through the line and mom or dad will probably give them cash. A lot of times they'll just give them the exact dollar amount they need for lunch. And they might lose a quarter or two. There might be something in the classroom that they want to buy, like a pretty pencil, and they use their lunch money to do that. So when they come through the lunch line and they don't have all of the money, my staff has pockets full of coins that they just pull out of their pocket and pay for the students.
What challenge is presented to the school by these sort of unpaid meal charges? Why can't you just hand a kid some food and say, eat?
Well, you know, we're funded by federal taxpayer dollars. And the purpose of the meal program is to provide a free or reduced priced meal to students who are economically disadvantaged. There are families who don't qualify, and those students have to pay for their meal. The government assistance that we do receive from the federal government is about 26 cents, and that meal can cost upwards of $2.75.
If a parent doesn't or can't pay the debt they owe you guys, who does the obligation fall to?
It's going to fall to the site budgets. They will have to pay for the uncollected debt.
So the individual schools themselves.
Right, which comes from our general fund money.
Stephanie Bruce is Director of Nutrition Services for the Palm Springs Unified School District. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And because we're Marketplace, we love to do the numbers. Here on The Weekend Show, we use them to put the events of the week in context. So with that, here are producers Tony Wagner and Sarah Menendez to bring us this week's news by the numbers. Tony, it's all yours.
Thanks, Adrian. Our first number is
7.5 million.
That's roughly how many dollars hackers are demanding to stop their leak of HBO's show Game of Thrones.
Last week, the hackers released episodes of Room 104 and Ballers.
This week, hackers sent HBO CEO Richard Plepler a ransom note demanding money for all the stolen data.
They want their multi-million dollar payment in Bitcoin.
Nerds. 31.
That's the percentage of female employees at Google.
The tech giant was in the spotlight this week. It fired an employee who sent an internal memo discouraging diversity efforts in tech hiring practices.
At Google, women make up 20% of technical staff and 31% of total staff. And they're not the only company with a gender gap.
Apple, Facebook, Amazon, and Microsoft all have similar disparities. 299.
That's how many dollars you'll have to shell out for Whim, a countertop frozen yogurt making machine.
Whim is kind of like a Keurig machine for froyo, churning out frozen treats in 10 minutes when you add the milk.
Seems like a dream until you factor in the cost of pods, $3 to $4 each.
Well, and plus, like, you gotta factor in the cost of, like, hot fudge and, like, maybe, like, some peanut butter and some chocolate chips and bananas and strawberries and crushed up Butterfinger bars and Cap'n Crunch and gummy worms.
Earlier in the show, we told you about a class action lawsuit in Michigan that claims literacy is a constitutional right under the 14th Amendment. A motion to dismiss that case was argued on Thursday. At its heart, the lawsuit is about law and education, and also about the economy. One of the stories from Lizzie O'Leary's reporting trip aired on Marketplace Morning Report. It was about a woman named Mercy Jones, a student of the Detroit public school system, and now a teacher herself. She was at the top of her high school class, but when she went to college, things were very different for her.
When I went to Michigan State, I was in for a rude awakening. I found out that I was behind the curveball. I promptly flunked out, and it kind of scarred me. So I didn't go back to school for like another 20 years after that.
In response to this story, listener Beth Wall left this comment at marketplace.org. It's read by our senior producer, Joanne Griffith.
Mercy Jones' story about not being ready for Michigan State struck a chord with me. My parents bought a house in Detroit in the 1940s because my older sister needed speech therapy, and Detroit public schools were the best at that time. In the 1960s, with the rebellion and white flight, the schools deteriorated very quickly, and as the youngest, who started kindergarten in 1968, my parents faced a stark choice: let me go through a public school system that was increasingly unable to educate kids to grade level, or find an alternative. I started in a kindergarten class of 42 with an amazing teacher, but by the time I reached second grade, there was no music, art, or physical education, and I was in a split grade of 30 kids. My parents intervened and I was able to get a partial scholarship to attend a private school in nearby Grosse Pointe, an affluent suburb. I was horrified to find out how behind I was, even though I was reading at a fifth grade level according to my public school. I quickly caught up and I was able to get into and succeed at Yale University. That's what breaks my heart about Mercy's story. She should have had access to the kind of education I had. She should have been able to succeed at Michigan State. It was through luck and parental intervention that our educational paths diverged so widely. I'm so glad she persisted and became a teacher. Thanks for sharing this story.
You can comment on any of the stories you hear on the show. We'd love to hear from you. Email us at weekend@marketplace.org. Leave us a comment on Facebook. Look for Marketplace Business News or call us. We've got a phone number, 1-800-648-5114. A new class of freshmen are on their way to college, a step that can be the culmination of years and years of saving and financial planning and penny pinching. Considering rising college tuitions, even 18 years of planning may not feel like enough. We called up Mark Kantrowitz for a little advice. He specializes in saving for school and is publisher of CapEx.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So what are the best ways to save for an education? What advice do you give families looking for ways to save?
Well, first of all, I would use a 529 college savings plan because it is a tax advantage way of saving. In many states, you can get a state income tax deduction on your contributions to the state's plan, in addition to the earnings being accumulated on a tax-deferred basis, and if you use a distribution to pay for qualified higher education expenses, it's entirely tax-free. The sooner you start saving for college, the better off you'll be because your greatest asset is time. If you start saving when the child was born, about a third of your college savings goal will come from the earnings, and the rest will come from the contributions. If you wait until the child enters high school, less than 10% of the college savings goal will come from the earnings, and you'll have to save six times as much per month to reach the same college savings goal.
I understand some states have better 529 plans than others. Is that right?
That's correct. Some states have lower fees on their direct sold plans than other states, and you can invest in any state's plan. So you should consider not just whether the state offers a state income tax deduction or tax credit, but also what are the fees. If the child is young, the fees have more of an impact than the state income tax benefit, whereas if the child is in high school, the state income tax benefit may outweigh the savings from having lower fees.
So you've also taken a look at securing scholarships. And I wonder if you could just talk me through what the world of scholarships looks like these days.
Well, there's about $6 billion in scholarships available from the private sector to help you pay for college. About one in eight students wins a private scholarship, and the average amount won is about $4,000 a year. So it's part of your plan for paying for college, but not the entire plan. You need to apply to as many scholarships as possible because the more scholarships applications you submit, the greater your chances are of winning one. But you should only apply to scholarships for which you're eligible. I recommend using a free scholarship matching service like the one that's available at capex.com/scholarships. This will match your background against a large database of scholarships, helping you find all the scholarships for which you're eligible. Just the key is it's got to be a free database. If you have to pay money to get money, it's probably a scam.
All right, stay away. We've talked about saving with 529s. We've talked about scholarships. Let's talk about loans and grants out there right now. What's that look like today?
For borrowing to pay for college, and more than two-thirds of bachelor degree recipients graduate with student loan debt, so it's hard to avoid student loans, I recommend that you borrow federal first. because the federal student loans are cheaper, they're more available, and they have better repayment terms than private student loans. Private student loans may be more advantageous when you're comparing them with the Parent PLUS loan, which has a higher interest rate and doesn't have the same benefits as federal student loans. So there, you can shop around and compare the interest rates and fees to see which is going to save you more money. But for the student loans, borrow the federal student loans.
Is there a rule of thumb about how much a student should or shouldn't borrow?
You should keep your student loan debt in sync with your income after graduation. Your total student loan debt at graduation should be less than your annual starting salary.
Got it.
If total debt is less than annual income, you'll be able to pay back your student loans in 10 years or less. And that's a reasonable and affordable amount of time. Anything more than that, you're going to struggle to make those loan payments, and you'll need to get an alternate repayment plan like extended repayment or income-driven repayment, which reduce the monthly payments by stretching out the term of the loan, and that increases the total interest you pay over the life of the loan.
For students who are starting college now this fall, if they haven't saved enough, anything they can do today to help them graduate with less debt?
Well, first of all, when you're looking at colleges, look at less expensive colleges, such as in-state public colleges. You get about as good quality education at half to a third of the price. Consider ways to save on living expenses. Live like a student while you're in school so you don't have to live like a student after you graduate.
Great advice.
Even simple things like you don't like the cafeteria food, so you eat out once a week. Let's say it's a $10 pizza a week. If you do that every week, by the time you graduate, that's $2,000. And if you use student loan money to pay for it, every dollar you borrow will cost about $2 by the time you pay back that debt. So that pizza will cost you $4,000. That's a lot of pizza.
It is a lot of pizza. Mark Kantrowitz is publisher of CapEx.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
We're talking education and the economy this week, and a few of you reached out with your back-to-school spending thoughts. Jennifer Peters from Erie, Pennsylvania, shares that she received a grant to update some software in her classroom. But she said, beyond the grant, I will need to use a large chunk of my budget towards its annual subscription. And she says that makes her a little stressed. And this teacher called to talk about how taxes, or rather a break from taxes, can help teachers get the supplies they need.
Hello, my name is Andrew Green. I live in Washington, D.C., and for 10 years, I've been a high school music teacher in D.C. public schools. Maryland has a tax-free weekend for school supplies around this time of year. My mother, who grew up in Maryland, said that she remembered driving out to Delaware to buy school supplies because they have no sales tax. D.C. tax law allows teachers to deduct $500 per year from their income for spending on their classroom supplies. I can tell you I spend no more than $500 ever per year. The two biggest things that I need to spend money on beyond what's provided by the school are copy paper and saxophone reeds. For some reason, those two things are always selling out. I'm interested in learning about the ways that taxes and back-to-school time intersect. Are there other intersections between taxes and back-to-school around the rest of the country? Are they meant to take the strain off teachers and families, or are they meant to promote spending?
Andrew's talking about something that does happen across the country. We'll address tax breaks and sales tax holidays and what they do to spending on the next episode of Marketplace Weekend. Now, parents around the country are driving their college freshmen to school, getting them all set up in the dorms, giving them final hugs, last kisses, and maybe a present. And I love you, I'll miss you, your awesome present. We spoke with Emma Mackinaw, a market writer at the BuzzFeed shopping team, about her picks for goodbye gifts for new freshmen. And they ran the gamut from useful to wacky, sometimes both, like in the case of a special shower caddy.
The most exciting thing that I've seen so far on the market that's new to me, at least, is called the Schlocker. And it's a shower caddy that you can lock So if you don't know your roommate and you were randomly selected, which is often a big concern for new students, this can kind of put your mind at ease that no one's going to have sticky fingers with, you know, your shampoo bottles, which sounds trivial before school, but when you're on a strict budget and you don't know people and everything is a little nerve-wracking, then this is just kind of an easy gift. And I found it on Amazon for $40, which is a pretty good price.
If your student is the type to get homesick, there are presents for that too.
Homesick candles are made by our product labs at BuzzFeed, and each candle is designed to have a scent that would remind you of your home state.
Apparently, to BuzzFeed, New York smells like an apple orchard. But if your student's dorm bans open flames, there are less fragrant options.
I found these state pendant necklaces for $16 on Amazon. A lot of students tend to feel homesick, especially the first year. So this is just like a little cute reminder that they're never too far away from home. There are 25 states available, so hopefully yours is included. But if not, I found a cute alternative on Etsy. They're these pillows that you can print your dog or cat on, and it's in the shape of them. So you can have your little cuddle buddy no matter where you are.
I kind of want a pillow shaped like my dog, but I'm not sure he's smart enough that it would do anything more than confuse him. For those wary of dining hall eats, Mackinac recommends a food subscription box. Some are healthier than others.
Subscription boxes are just like a super easy gift to give to college students because it's just something that they can look forward to every month in the mail. I remember as a student, I always looked forward to getting a care package from my mom. And, you know, once you start the subscription, you don't have to think about it.
$25 will get you a monthly ramen subscription. And that does seem steep for ramen, but it's not cup of noodles. According to the company, it's premium packaged ramen from around the world. I'd probably prefer the homemade care package. Brownies, cookies, whatever it was, wrapped in bubble wrap and plastic grocery store bags. A little note. But if you're not keen on sending your students sugar or sodium, there are plenty of other options. Mackinac picked noise-canceling headphones as a top fun gift that's also useful.
That's a great gift for anyone who's stylish or just is kind of techie, but also they're noise canceling, so they can focus more in the library or if they have a loud floor for their dorm, that's super helpful so they can keep studying.
And to get new students settled in dorms and spruce up their home away from home, Mackinac suggests aromatherapy diffusers, nice bed sheets, mirrors, throw pillows. But the ultimate dorm improvement?
This I didn't think of until I was at school, and I wish someone had told me to get a mattress topper. So that's obviously a really big parent gift because, I mean, like, what cool aunt is going to get you that? But, you know, for the twin-sized options, which is what you'll obviously get, you can get them as low as $20 on Amazon. The highest I saw was, like, $45. And it makes such a big difference. My bed felt like a prison bed. So I wish that I had 3 more inches of memory foam for my back.
Because you learn better when you get a good night's sleep, right? Next week on Marketplace Weekend, she's back. Yes, I'm talking about Lizzie, but also she who knows all things jobs and HR, Allison Green from Ask a Manager. Last month, she shared her wisdom on what to wear and not to wear in the office. Now we're after your questions about kids at the office and managing employees with little and not so little ones. Send us your questions and comments. Email weekend at marketplace.org or leave a voicemail at 1-800-648-5114. And that's Marketplace Weekend for the week. The show is produced by Eliza Mills and Paulina Velasco. Joanne Griffith is our senior producer, and Daniel Ramirez is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Satara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our vice president and general manager. I'm Adrienne Hill in for Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.